You can think of operating systems as defining and managing resources. It's one way to look at them. And it is the scheduling part of the operating system that is responsible for management. There are lots of different schedulers that you can look at, and in fact, one of the things I often say is that operating systems are just filled with schedulers. That's why I don't feel so bad about slighting this particular chapter of schedulers, because we'll be looking at schedulers over and over again, for example, for primary store, for the disk, and so on. In particular, tonight, and in this set of lectures, we're going to be principally concerned with the CPU. Scheduling the CPU, managing that as a resource, and also defining virtual CPUs. But the things that we talk about here, in particular with respect to things like the criteria that you apply to evaluate schedulers and the algorithms that you use, are applicable at lots of different places. So even though I'm talking about it and the book talks about it in the context of CPU management, you can think about these things in terms of, for example, disk management or primary store, too, as we will see. So that's the first task of a scheduler, is to manage the resources. But manage, what does it mean to manage? When you're managing something, what does that mean? How do you manage something like the CPU? And essentially it means who gets the CPU. That's essentially what, in this case, management means. But, as we'll talk about when we talk about criteria, it also means making sure that the resources behave in a way that they are specified to behave. This is particularly true with respect to processes. So another way to think about schedulers, as we're talking about, is they manage processes also. In fact, since I complained to somebody about saying it, I should not say it, who gets the CPU? Right, so we have two resources now that are managed by the scheduler, the CPU, which is sort of the obvious one if you think about it, and then the other one is the processes themselves, but not so much in terms of creating them, but giving them the desirable behavior that we'll discuss in a couple of minutes. But in addition to managing these resources in this way, they also create the resources. Now, you could argue, I suppose, if you wanted to, that this is, in fact, just another aspect of behavior, but I prefer to break them out separately. You can combine them if you want. And in particular, the resource that we're going to be concerned with respect to this chapter, is virtual CPUs. And the behavior that we would like to have, if you want to think about it that way, is we would like to make it appear that every process that executes on its own CPU. So there's one process, one CPU. Boom. And that's the ideal. That's what you'd like to have. Right? Because that's essentially zero overhead. That process gets in that CPU and it just grinds until it's done. And then it leaves. So that's the abstraction that we would like to implement, and the principal way that we do that is through CPU scheduling. There are some other mechanisms at play, which we'll talk about, but they are in service to this notion of scheduling. All right, so these are the two principal tasks that a scheduler can perform. And depending upon who's looking at the system for what purpose, they vary in importance. So let's take a look at the notion of criteria, evaluation for, in particular, CPU scheduling, but also more generally. And there's a lot of criteria that you can use, so I'll just list some of them. And the first one is throughput, which is essentially processes per unit time. How many processes can a scheduler shuffle through the CPU per unit time? And the unit time can be whatever you might find convenient, like an 8-hour day or maybe a number of processes per second. And this is the complete process. So it's from start to end. And I should say that all of these are complicated because once you look in the details, I mean, there's lots of different things. For example, even though I say start to end, what does that mean? Does that mean the first time the process hits the CPU, or does it mean the first time that the process enters the system? Similarly for end, does this mean the last time the process exits the CPU, or does it mean the last, or when the process exits the whole system? Right, so it becomes complicated, but the general idea is, you know, how much stuff can you shove through the CPU per unit time? The next criteria that you can use is utilization. How busy is the managed resource? And that can range, for example, from 0% to 100%. 0% means it's not being used at all. 100% is it's constantly in use. And how would you assign value judgments to these numbers? What would you say is a good utilization versus a bad utilization? Right. Essentially, zero is bad because that's a resource that's laying idle. That resource is costing you money, electricity, for example. So if it's not doing anything, it's a cost. It's not a benefit. On the other hand, if you have 100% utilization, then that resource is being used all the time. Presumably, it's paying back whatever it costs to run it. So that's good. So the idea here is to drive things towards 100% utilization whenever possible. Now, there's actually some interesting points about that, and if we have time, we may go into it. You don't want to quite go to 100, but you want to get as close as possible. For throughput, how would you characterize good versus bad there? Well, what does fast and slow mean, though? There's a relationship there, right, between process time and throughput. But can you give me a more direct answer? Exactly. You want higher numbers. So if you have big numbers, you have either a large number of processes or a small unit time or both. And that's good because that means you're moving things through the system as quickly as possible. So higher numbers are better, and this is open-ended as opposed to 100% here. Well, I suppose if you drive the system to 100% utilization, you can improve. Well, is that true? No. Is that all right? Here's a good question. See, this is why it's tricky. Suppose I have 100% utilization. Can I improve throughput? So I have 100% utilization and I have some throughput. Can I improve throughput? This is actually an important question because people will trick you. Not only for throughput, but for all kinds of things. And productivity in particular is another example. So, and here's a good test question too. 100% utilization, let's assume we're talking about CPUs here. Principally, 100% utilization, can I improve throughput? I have some throughput, can I improve it? Sorry, the answer is no. Okay, so we have a vote for no. Excellent. The trick is throughput is a ratio. And I just told you that, right? And if you want to diddle with a ratio, you can do two things, right? You can change the denominator or you can change the numerator. If utilization is at 100%, it seems like you can't change either one of these things. But in fact, you can change the numerator by using smaller processes. So if you admit smaller processes, you are having more processes per unit time through the CPU. Therefore, you increase the throughput. So by biasing your scheduler towards small processes, even at 100% utilization, you can improve throughput. See, this is why these things are tricky. You can play all these kinds of games. Oh, and the reason I mentioned this is because I got in a discussion once with somebody. What were they saying? Oh, we were talking about whether or not the economy was good or bad. And this person was saying, oh, the economy's great. And I was saying, no, the economy is terrible. And she said, well, how can you say that? Productivity is up. Right? And so what's the answer to that? This is how terrible things are. This was actually in the 90s. I was in graduate school at the time, and it's still true. So how can I say, what was my answer to that? She said the economy's doing great. Look at productivity. It's up. And I said the economy is bad. Look at productivity. It's up. What was my argument? You have to know what productivity is, but I'm not going to tell you.
You look further back in time.
No, same period of time. That's tricky. That's not nice. We're looking at the same period of time. Productivity is a ratio. Output over input. Okay? So you can make productivity go up in two ways. You can increase output or decrease input. What's a big measure of input? It's cost, wages. So you can make productivity go up by socking wages, which is exactly what's been happening for the past 40 years. That's one of the reasons why productivity is going up. And from one point of view, yes, the economy is improving because productivity is increasing. On the other hand, wages are going down, and that's why productivity is increasing. So the economy is not improving that much. Or it's improving spottily. There are some people who are doing well and other people who are not. All right, I'm getting off the subject. But it's the idea that you have to be careful when you deal with a ratio. Other criteria, where is it? Oh, turnaround is another example. So there's a rule of thumb. I should not digress long enough for the pen to dry out. Turnaround is, in a sense, throughput restricted to a single process. All right, throughput measures how quickly things go through the system. Turnaround measures how quickly a particular process goes through the system. Although, again, you have to be careful about what you mean by start and end. So we can define turnaround as per process residency time. Now, you might be saying to yourself, well, why is this interesting? Why is this not, as I said, some characteristic of throughput? And to answer that question, we have to take a look at some of the things that schedulers exploit in order to do their job. So keep this notion of turnaround in mind, plus the fact that it's really difficult to actually characterize. But it's something that, once you can define it, it can be measured fairly well. Another measure for schedulers is waiting time. How much non-productive time does a particular aspect of the system, usually processes, how much time are they spent not doing anything useful? And we'll see in a couple of minutes that's essentially a measure of queue residency time. Response time is a fairly obvious one, although, again, it's kind of difficult to... This is interactive response time, although you can also think about response time in terms of other kinds of external stimuli, like response to sensors and things like that. This is actually an important characteristic for operating systems, right? Because operating systems are continually reacting to external events, interrupts, signals, and so forth. And they have to do so in a very fast way. Now, with respect to scheduling, of course, this doesn't really apply because that's automatic. It's part of the hardware, the context switch from user space to kernel space. But once you're in the operating system, then you have these various measures of response time that you can look at. This is principally used in terms of interactive batch or interactive jobs where somebody's sitting at a terminal and typing away, but you can also imagine it with respect to, for example, autonomous robots that have to react to changes in terrain, things like that. And there are lots of other ones. Principally, we'll be interested in throughput and utilization, but some of these other ones we'll measure as we go along. There are some other ones which are a little softer, and one that we'll talk about is the idea of fairness. This is a particularly squishy concept, but it's important in the sense that it helps to characterize behaviors of schedulers. And roughly speaking, it's a measure of proportional sharing. This will become much more important when we talk about concurrency, the idea of fairness and concurrency. But we can also talk about it here. And in particular, we're going to look at an extreme case when fairness is not obtained, and that's the idea of starvation. All right, I think that's enough. Like I said, you can define these things all day long. And people do. But that's the basic idea. So as we look at these various kinds of scheduling algorithms, we'll be asking ourselves, well, you know, how does it satisfy the criteria? And we can also turn that around and notice that, well, you know, this particular scheduling algorithm doesn't deal with utilization well. how can we change that algorithm to improve utilization that we get? And that would help us drive to a new kind of algorithm based on improved utilization, for example. So let's see. I get the feeling I want to say more about this. So manage the resources. Well, let's go on. So with the basic idea in mind and these basic measures, let's think about how we can do scheduling in the simplest possible way. And let's concentrate our attention on which process gets the CPU. So it is the objective of this scheduler to answer the question, which process gets the CPU? Give me the simplest possible one. Exactly, first come, first get. But what happens when the second process comes and the first one's in the CPU? And more importantly, what happens when the third process comes? Right, but then the question becomes, what happens when the first process leaves? But is that the simplest one you can get? What's the other possibility? Right, you can arbitrarily pick a waiter. It's less restrictive. There is a bigger class of schedulers that satisfy. Notice that, so essentially what you do is you put them in a queue, right? Notice that a queue-based scheduler satisfies this constraint. But a scheduler that can satisfy this constraint is not necessarily queue-based. It could be stack-based, for example. A stack-based scheduler will also satisfy this constraint. Or a scheduler where you just have a set of waiting processes and the scheduler plucks one out. Yes, so rather than go FIFO, you'd go LIFO. The last process to come in would be the first process to get the CPU. No, it's not. But it satisfies an arbitrary pick of a waiting process. It covers the criteria. So essentially, when I say arbitrary, there's really no criteria. It's kind of like the old joke, pick a random number, 42, pick another random number, 42. Those are two perfectly acceptable random numbers. But over the long term, they're not, if you do some statistical analysis. But individually, they are. Same thing here. Everybody got this? Okay, let's evaluate it in terms of the criteria up here. In particular, let's take a look at utilization. Actually, we can take a look at throughput and utilization. How would you characterize first come, first get, and let's just assume an arbitrary next waiter? So how about utilization? And here you have to be careful, because now we can get into the kinds of characteristics that schedulers can exploit. Process execution characteristics that can be exploited by schedulers. So what about utilization? What do people think about utilization in this scheme? Good or bad or indifferent? Exactly. Well, it kind of seems like the CPU is like burning all the time. So it seems like it would be 100% utilization. Really good. So it seems like this would be good for utilization. What about throughput? Throughput's a little trickier. And let's assume that we'll just say, let me say sets. Processes don't exist if they're not waiting for the CPU. So that gives you a fairly concise definition of what the lifetime of a process is, and that should give you a pretty natural way to think about throughput. So what about throughput? Throughput would seem to be reasonably good, right? I mean, it's hard to figure out how you could do better. You put something in, it grinds away until it's done, and then you just go on to the next process. Anything else you do is going to make the process in the CPU run longer. Okay, now that assumes some information that we haven't yet talked about, but if you've done the reading, you understand where that comes from. So anything we do to change this seems like is going to make throughput worse, but in fact it turns out that throughput is not very good, depending on the nature of the processes. So it seems as if we have throughput being very good, utilization being as good as it can get, right? Can't get better than 100%. Although if we have multi-cores, we have to be careful because now you have CPUs, single CPUs that are executing two processes. So it's like, wow, 200%. But never mind that. So it seems like we're done. Here we are, simplest possible scheduler, does the job, gives me, and we have to worry about these other things. There may be some things here. No, let's not go through it. But we could go through these other ones and see whether or not the simplest possible scheduler, in fact, solves these issues. So it seems like we're done. We have come up with a schedule that gives me perfect utilization, high throughput. But clearly that's not the case, or the Chapter 5 would have been much shorter than it is. So now we have to figure out what goes wrong. And what goes wrong is the execution behavior of processes. And this is where scheduling becomes interesting. Because if this is our point of view of the world, scheduling is trivial. So we need to have a more realistic point of view in order to have a more interesting kind of scheduling. Actually, I'm saying this wrong. The view of the world that supports this kind of scheduling is not realistic. So this is not a realistic scheduler, so we need to figure out a more realistic view of the world and indicate why this scheduler does not really serve as well as it appears to be serving. So let's do that next. And in order to do that, we need to take a look at process execution behavior. So if we look at a process in execution, it has a start lifetime, and eventually it stops. Notice that we're assuming a finite lifetime here, which is not necessarily the case. For example, you're writing a program that doesn't have a finite lifetime, potentially anyway. It could just run forever. But we won't consider those. We'll just assume processes that have finite lifetimes. The question is, what's going on between here and here? What goes on between the start and the stop of a process execution? And in particular, what is the assumption made by our simplest possible scheduler? Right, exactly. The process gets into the CPU and grinds all the way to the end, and then stops, and then we go on to the next process. So that's that is the definition of what a process looks like with respect to the simplest possible scheduler. And if this is in fact true, then this is indeed the best possible scheduler we can get. But is it true? What's missing from this picture? Exactly, and? Right, I.O. So we don't have I.O. in here. If you think about, for example, the compute-bound programs that you know of, like, for example, weather simulations or oil exploration data analysis, those are heavily CPU-bound processes. But even there, there is usually some section at the beginning in which there is the data being read in. So you're going to have some amount of I.O. In particular, you're going to have some amount of I. All right? And then you may have a lot of CPU. And then you may have a lot of, well, let's just say some output. So even in a process that's heavily compute-bound, you're going to have some input and output. And, of course, for more general processes, you're going to have a lot more regions of input and output interspersed throughout. So you're going to have some input, you're going to have some CPU, and then maybe some more input, and then maybe some more CPU. And then, and just to make it generic, you're going to have I.O. and CPU and so forth and so on through the life of the program. And in fact, what you can do now is you can start to characterize these processes. What's the extreme? So this is seismic data analysis, where you read in a huge chunk of data, and then you grind on it for a couple hours, and then you spit out the results. Okay, what's at the other end, the opposite end of this spectrum? Right, which would be, can you give me an example of a program like that? Exactly. In fact, let's even bias it more. Let's say something like VI. Right, which is not doing things like WYSIWYG formatting or grammar checking or spelling or anything like that. It's just, you know, put the characters in the buffer and then wait for the next command. So essentially what you've got is you've got very tiny slices of CPU and these huge I.O. gaps as you're waiting for that moron at the other end of the device to push a key on the keyboard. Right, so you're going to have very small slices here and then large I.O. operations. So what you can do is you can characterize the behavior of the process in terms of the percentage of CPU. And then from that you subtract this from 100 to get the percentage of I.O. And what you get is a range of processes. These are known as compute-bound processes. I can't spell and talk at the same time. Compute-bound processes. And then these are I.O.-bound processes. Notice also, you might expect that response time is not something really important for compute-bound processes. On the other hand, response time is very important for I/O-bound processes. So there's an example of where the criteria vary. And in fact, a scheduler good for this may not in fact be good for this, and we'll deal with that towards the end of the lecture. Now, with this in mind, let's go back to our evaluation of utilization and throughput with respect to our very simple scheduler. How does it do with respect to throughput and utilization now? Well, what about throughput? Do I want to say throughput? Well, yeah, let's start with throughput. What about throughput? Is it good or bad now? Relative to our previous evaluation, before we drew this distinction, right, before we had this distinction, we had this. And we made a judgment with respect to its throughput and utilization for that matter. The question is, now that we have this model, this slightly more complicated model of process execution behavior, how does our throughput stand with respect to our previous evaluation? Okay, and why did it go down? What was it about knowing this that made us decrease? Well, that's not quite the right judgment to make. Because just knowing this isn't really going to change anything about throughput. But it will change our opinion of whether or not the throughput was good or not. Throughput is, if I put the same mix of jobs in without knowing what those jobs were, we're going to get a throughput. And the question is that throughput good or bad? Without knowing anything, we have to say it's good. Because it appears that we have a minimal amount of interference one process to the next. So everything is executing as fast as it possibly can, therefore the throughput cannot possibly get better, so it's the best possible throughput. But if we now know this, okay, that our jobs look like this or like that or like that, throughput doesn't change. But our opinion of throughput does change. And how does that opinion change? Again, we have the same mix of jobs that we're submitting. Or if you want, just go back to the original data that we used to evaluate this scheduler without knowing about these kinds of process classifications. The point is we have changed our knowledge of what's being executed, and that does not change the throughput. The throughput remains the same, but our opinion of whether that throughput is good or not should change. And my question is, how should it change? And the reason I'm sort of going on about this is because this is going to be the point that we're going to use to derive our next scheduler. Because then we can fix that problem and get a new scheduler, which is the way things usually work. People say, ooh, this scheduler sucks, figure out why, and then implement a new scheduler that fixes it. So what is our, and this also indicates how it is we expect schedulers to increase or enforce behavior. So again, now that we know that we have this mix of jobs, and I'm not telling you anything about the particular mix, I'm just saying we have all three kinds of jobs, right, all along the spectrum. How does that change our opinion of the throughput? Also utilization, too. I will collapse them together because it's a mix, right? We have all three kinds. You're right, it does. Let's assume I have one of those, too. I mean, we have one from each category. Compute-bound, I/O-bound, and something in the middle. It's just the fact that these processes exist in our mix of scheduled processes. That's correct, but what is the you're going at it backwards, so I have to turn you around. What is the consequence of that? I'm trying to come up with the consequence and then get to the point you just raised. So what is the consequence of your observation? We could do it that way, I guess. What's the answer? The answer is we are unsatisfied because we have these idle times, right? What is I/O? I/O is essentially wasted time. The process cannot do anything until it receives its input. And that's going to take a long time for one of two reasons. First of all, it's going out to something that's very slow relative to the CPU. It's going out to the disk, the network, the tape drive. All these things are orders of magnitude slower than the CPU. Alright, so when a process does I/O, even though it's in the CPU, even though it's making the CPU warm, it is not doing anything useful. It's waiting. Alright? And it's even worse for these interactive jobs, because then at the other end of the line is this human, this bag of meat, who takes 5 minutes to just figure out what the next key press is. Right, so that's even worse. That's even slower than Ethernet. So from that point of view, yeah, utilization is great, but it's a lot of wasted cycles. Cycles being burnt to no good purpose. And consequently, throughput. We should be unhappy with throughput. If we didn't know anything about the jobs, we would say, wow, throughput is great and we can't possibly do better. But looking at, for example, jobs down here where they are mostly I.O., they are mostly wasted cycles, we could be doing much better. We could be having processes shuffling in and out when this process is just sitting there waiting for that bag of meat to do something. Right, so in both cases, knowing what the actual, well, not actual, but at least having a reasonable model of the components of a process execution in terms of whether it's grinding in the CPU or waiting for I.O. means that this particular scheduler is no longer very good because it's very wasteful in terms of CPU cycles. Now, if that's not the case, if we don't care about CPU cycles, then this is a great scheduler, and that's often the case. For example, if you're dealing with embedded systems, they have dedicated CPUs specifically designed to run a task, right? And that's it. That's all they do. So using this very simple kind of scheduler is perfect because you don't care about wasting cycles. But in general, you do care. You like to have other aspects. Notice that even if you don't care about the CPU, it's like, those cycles are free, right? I paid my $300 for that chip, and I can run it from now till next Wednesday, and all those cycles are mine. Even then, you still have other characteristics like response time and turnaround time and wait time that you may be interested in. And this particular scheduler may, in fact, do very poorly. In fact, does do very poorly on these other characteristics. So, in fact, we do need to move on beyond this very simple possible scheduler. And I told you what's wrong with it. And so the question then becomes, what's the next scheduler to do? What scheduler can we implement that takes advantage of this knowledge to give us a throughput and, let's say, utilization, let's concentrate on those two things, that we can be more satisfied with given this particular mix of jobs? Exactly. The point here is that if a process starts doing I.O. or starts doing anything, I'm using I.O. here, but it doesn't have to be I.O. It could be synchronizing with another process, for example. I'm just using I.O. as a sort of a simple point of view. It's just, the point is, it's not grinding away in the CPU. It's not using the ALU, for example, is another way to think about it. All right, if a process is waiting, it's just spinning in a loop, maybe checking a status bit someplace. So rather than have that process clog up the CPU, just get rid of that process and replace it with some other process. All right, so now it's no longer a simple process scheduler because we have to move things in and out. We would like to have a scheduler that moves processes in and out of the CPU based on cycle quality. For some definition of cycle quality, which I kind of hinted at here, you know, whether we're actually grinding away in the ALU or we're spinning in a loop looking at some status bit someplace. If we're going to do this, what do we need to have in order to be able to implement this? What kind of mechanism are we going to be needing? What kind of mechanism do we need in order to provide a scheduler with this ability? You should know this from your programming assignments. We'll get to that in a minute. But again, the idea here is moving processes in and out of the CPU. And then the question becomes, well, what do you do when they're ready? So yeah, that will be the second mechanism. But this is the first mechanism. And what is that? No, because again, we're interested in moving things in and out of the CPU. Now, they do have to go somewhere, but we assume that we have task control blocks. Right, and that takes up the storage, so we'll just manipulate those and not worry about that stuff. Well, yes, we need that, but again, we're specifically interested in, why do you move things in and out of the CPU? It involves the registers. How? We know why. This is why. This is why. So now we need to know how. We need the mechanism that lets us do that. Because if we are going to write a scheduler that exploits this observation we made, then we're going to have to be able to do this somehow. And the question is, what's the mechanism that lets us do that? Batch and store. Yes, but in service to what? context switch. You move a process into or out of the CPU. All right, that's what's known as a context switch. Notice that we have to do a context switch at the beginning and at the end, but this is actually context switches that take place in between. Because you could think about, for example, there is no context before a process begins, or meaningful process. In this simplest schedule, there is no meaningful context before the process begins and after it ends. So from that point of view, I suppose you could think of it as a context switch, but it's kind of a special kind, a one-sided context switch. But if you're starting to move things in and out during execution, then you actually have a meaningful context switch on both sides of the switch. So we need to do a context switch, and some of you have already indicated how this works. Essentially, you just move state into and from the PCB. So you have the processor control block, and it's a transfer of data between the CPU and the PCB. Okay, and again, you've all implemented, well, you may have implemented it in your first programming assignment. You're absolutely going to implement it in your second. And because context switching will be done a lot in a executing system, it usually has to be very fast. Usually it gets a hardware assist in the form of special instructions that you can use to context switch in a single instruction, as opposed to going through a loop and storing data from primary store into the registers and vice versa. Depends on the hardware. So this is one mechanism that we need, the context switch mechanism, and we're not going to say too much more about it, but keep in mind that it's there because it does have a significant influence on the performance of the scheduler. If context switches are difficult, you don't want to do them very often. And then we need at least one other mechanism to start, and a couple of people have already mentioned it. So let's think about what happens. We have a process that grinds along in the CPU, in the ALU, throwing off all those nice arithmetic results, and then it decides to read in the next chunk of seismic data. So it goes out to the disk and reads a couple of megabytes of data. All right, so now it's goodbye for the next half second, okay, which if you're grinding away at 3 gigahertz is a really long time. So the process, the scheduler will say, all right, so much for you. You essentially get ejected from the CPU, so we do a context switch to the next waiting schedule. The next waiting process enters the CPU, but eventually this I/O request is satisfied. That couple of megabytes is read in, and this process is now ready to execute. What happens next? This is actually an interesting question. The correct answer to that question is, it depends on the scheduler, whichever scheduler you're using. But in general, for any particular scheduler you choose to pick, what happens next? Be slightly more general. What is the process list? What does that... Right, but what is that link list for? What is it? What is its purpose? What's special about those processes? Exactly. These are processes that are waiting to get to the CPU. So we need to keep a... No, some processes are waiting for their data to come in from the disk. So other processes are synchronizing with some other process. And some processes are waiting for their bag of meat to give them the next character. We will talk about that in the next section. Keep a collection of ready processes. At this point, we will stop, and I will go back to a point that I mentioned briefly in processes, but didn't cover in detail because there was really no reason to talk about it then. Now we have a reason to talk about it, and that's the idea of process state. Who can tell me about process state? Either you remember what we talked about briefly, or the textbook actually covered this. What is process state, first of all? Exactly. So give me a general description. Okay. Okay, but how would you characterize all of those different states? What are they doing? Give me a one-phrase characterization of all of that. Right, that's an example, but again, give me a general characterization. It indicates the status of the process, or it characterizes the process, or it indicates where the process is in its execution history is a slightly longer-winded way to say that. And so the various kinds of states that a process can be in, and again, it depends on the nature of the system and how you want to draw the distinctions that a process can exist in. But very simple ones are running, which means in the CPU. It could be ready, which means not able to use the CPU, but not in the CPU. And I'll draw that distinction in just a minute. Waiting to use the CPU. Because somebody raised this question about how is it possible. I don't remember exactly what the statement was, but they said, well, aren't all processes waiting to get into the CPU? And that's the distinction I'm trying to draw here. And then the third possibility is blocked. Right, exactly. And then the third possible state in this very simple diagram is blocked, which means unable to use the CPU. Unable to use the CPU usefully. So in other words, you could put a blocked process in the CPU, but the only thing it can usefully do is spin, not using the ALU until some bit indicates that whatever it asked to have done has been finished and it can continue work. So that process can be in the CPU, but as we've argued, that's wasteful. If we can actually get that process out of the CPU, replace it with something more useful, we can increase throughput and have the same amount of utilization, but somehow better utilization in the sense that the CPU is being used more to its needs. And of course, we can refine this. We can say that, oh, it's blocked on I/O, or it's blocked on synchronization, or it's blocked on a particular kind of I/O, like network I/O or disk I/O, so forth and so on. But this will be good enough for us. And then, of course, once we have these states, and then, of course, there are other ones like new and exited and so forth and so on. Once we have these states, we can arrange them in what's known as a state transition diagram, which indicates how a process in one state can then move on to some other state. So, for example, if I have a running process, it can transition into a blocked state. And then from the block state, the process can transition to a ready state. And then from the ready state can transition to the running state. So in this case, this arc we could label. So what would be a label we could put on this arc to indicate the source of this transition? This one, from anyone for that matter. Running, from running to ready could be start I/O. Do a disk read, do a network read. From this transition, from block to ready, I/O done. This is the interesting transition from ready to running. The CPU is free, I guess is one way to say it, but there are in fact others. And we can draw a more complicated picture. For example, there could be another transition to done, right, to indicate that the process is finished execution. And then presumably we'd have one from up here pointing into the ready queue and so forth and so on. But essentially what the scheduler is going to do is it is going to essentially either add or take away arrows or redefine the existing arrows to indicate when these transitions occur. Questions about that? Again, I mentioned this briefly. I don't think I actually even drew a picture of a state transition diagram because we didn't really need to look at one back then. Now we have a reason to look at it because this is essentially a picture of what schedulers do. So all of these arrows are essentially driven by the scheduler. It looks at the behavior of the process in the various states and reacts to that behavior by moving the process from one place to another. And by moving, of course, I essentially mean swapping pointers around, but you can think in terms of moving the process itself if you like. Now we pretty much have everything we need to start thinking about new kinds of schedulers to help deal with this simple as possible scheduler problem. So you have everything you need to know. Give me a better scheduler. Describe a better scheduler to me. We would like to do something better than this, and better in this case means improve throughput. We would like to move jobs, processes through the system faster than we do in the simple case where a process gets in the CPU, just stays there until it's done. Give me a scheduler that does that. Okay, what does round robin? Give me a simpler scheduler that does that. Yes, round robin will do that. Although actually it's not the best approach to take. So let's think about another approach to take. I'm actually to give you, well, I don't know if I should, let me not, do I want to beat you over the head with this? Let me not. what I was looking for is I was looking for a category of schedulers. How would you characterize this scheduler? I don't know if this is a fair question. This is what's known as a non-preemptive scheduler. Once the process hits the CPU, it stays there. So this kind of scheduler that has this approach is known as non-preemptive. And what kind of scheduler do we want? We want a preemptive scheduler. Now, I should be careful because the book defines preemption in a particular way. And I suppose that their definition is fine. It's just more restrictive than what I'm saying. The book essentially defines preemption as ripping out a process from the CPU at a time that is not obviously a point for preemption. Okay, and that would be the round robin case, as we'll talk about in a minute. What I'm talking about is pulling a process out of the CPU at an obvious time, like when it waits for I.O. That seems like an obvious time to exempt that process from the CPU. But the textbook would not consider that to be a preemptive scheduler because it's an obvious time as opposed to sort of like pulling it out of the CPU in the middle of a calculation. I don't know that I particularly like that definition, but, I mean, there it is. I'm using it in the more general sense of the CPU gets ejected, sorry, the process gets ejected from the CPU before it ends. Right, so it's not resident in the CPU the entire time it's executing. That's what I consider to be preemption. All right, so what we need now is a preemptive scheduler, and I guess what I will do is just sort of go through them. So the first scheduler that the textbook talks about is known as first come, first serve, or you can also call it FIFO. That is, it can or cannot be a non-preemptive scheduler. We'll talk about how you would have a preemptive first come, first serve in a minute. It gets complicated, but you can have preemptive first come, first serve. We'll talk about how you do that in a minute. But as we're talking about it now, it's not. And here, as we were talking about earlier, replace this arbitrary pick with a queue-based pick. So you have a queue of ready processes. When the process currently occupying the CPU leaves the CPU for whatever reason, either a termination or a block, then you bring in the queue, the head of the queue, as the resident of the next CPU. The next resident of the CPU. When the blocked process becomes ready to run, it goes on the end of the queue and then traverses through the queue. This improves throughput because now we no longer have hogs that occupy the CPU and they're not doing anything. So they're out of the CPU and we can put other processes through the system. Right, so we have an improvement in throughput. We also have sort of an improvement of utilization. There's an overhead associated with doing these context switches and managing the queues, but it's not that great depending upon how often you do the context switch. It's a very simple scheduler to implement. The next possibility is shortest job next, in which the queue turns into a priority queue. Well, let me not say priority queue. The queue becomes a min heap based on runtime. All right, so that means that the top of the heap, which would be the process that gets the CPU next, has the smallest total runtime of all the processes in the heap. We can get to that in a minute. But this is usually not considered to be a preemptive algorithm, but it can be preemptive. And also, we can change this. I specified it in terms of total runtime, but you can also think about it in terms of burst time, CPU residency time. So this actually is kind of complicated, but we'll get into that in a minute. And the principal advantage of shortest job next is it gives optimal average wait times. So that's why people talk about it. We can sort of think about that. If we draw a picture, we have three processes in the queue, P1, P2, and P3. Okay, and we can arrange them this way. Actually, let me make this a little bit more obvious. we can arrange the queue this way, or we can arrange it this way, P3, P2, and P1. All right, now these more or less look like they're the same queue, but the question is, which one of these has the smaller average wait time? If you do it real quickly, all right, what's the average wait time? It is essentially So what's the wait time for P1? It's 0 because it's the head of the queue. What's the wait time for P2? It's P1 because it's the head of the queue. What's the wait time for P3? It's P1 plus P2, and then you divide that by 3. Okay, that's the average wait time for the processes. Now, what's this? This is, again, 0 plus P3 plus P3 plus P2 divided by 3. Again, which one of these is smaller? Without even just looking at the picture, it's got to be this one because this one contains P1, and P1 is like half of total execution time. So anything that doesn't involve half has got to be smaller. And in fact, you can prove that. So that's why we have optimal average wait times. That's why shortest job next is people think about it because we have optimal average wait times. The difficulty here, it's not a very practical algorithm. The difficulty is computing the total runtime. You can do that statistically if you have enough data, but if you don't, you have to guess. Plus, you can look at either total runtime or burst time. And that is, if we go back to our picture here, and let's just take a process in the middle of the spectrum, right? It computes a while, waits a while, computes a while, and waits a while. Right, as it's computing, it's essentially generating bursts of CPU activity. And if you take a look in the text, it turns out that the burst time is like 10 milliseconds. Okay, that's roughly 95 to 99% of CPU burst times are going to be within 10 milliseconds long. And in fact, it's even probably less than that, closer to 2, if you look at that little graph they have. Let's see. So 10 milliseconds is what? It's a hundredth of a second. What you can do is you can compute the average of the burst times for a particular process. And by computing that average, you can predict when a process leaves the CPU, how long it will be in the CPU when it next gains the CPU, right? You can estimate the next burst time. Right. And you can also use that to determine the position in the queue. And this goes back to the question about preemption. Right. So the question becomes, what happens either when I have a very small burst that enters the minimum heap, or I have a new job with a small overall runtime? Well, it's going to rise to the top of the heap. And then what happens? Right. I have a job that's, let's say, going to execute in 5 minutes, or let me not say 5 minutes, 5 seconds total. And then a new job comes in that's going to execute in 3 seconds total. Well, let's suppose the CPU job has now been resident for 1 second, has 4 seconds to go. What do we do? Well, what does the scheduler do in particular? If this is a preemptive scheduler, it will yank the current resident process because it has a longer total execution time and put the new shorter total execution time in the CPU. If it is a non-preemptive algorithm, scheduler, it will leave it as it is. Similarly, with respect to the burst time. Right? If you have a text editor, which is going to have a very small burst time, it's going to put a couple of characters in the buffer and then just essentially wait for the next character, that's going to have a very small burst time. That's going to rise to the top of the heap, and in a preemptive shortest job next, it is going to get the CPU. That's very good for responsiveness because the bag of meat has given a character, so that character gets put in the buffer and displayed, and then you go back and wait for the next character. So that's good for responsiveness. Next up is priority scheduling, but I want to save that one because priority scheduling is special. And then finally, somebody mentioned round-robin scheduling. So let's have a little test. I said that there were two tasks that a scheduler is assigned to deal with. We've been dealing with principally one of those tasks, which is what? Right, who gets the CPU? Right, so it's a resource management problem. What was the other task a scheduler had? What was the other task? I gave you two tasks at the beginning of the lecture. What was the other task? That's what we're doing now. What's the other task? All right, create resources. And what resource are we interested in creating with a CPU scheduler? Virtual CPUs. Have we done that yet? Not really. So now we need to actually make good on that promise and come up with what's known as a virtual CPU. In other words, we want to make every process look like it owns the CPU. It's one CPU, one process. And the question is, how can we do that? The answer is, as always, we multiplex. So the scheduler is going to have to multiplex the CPU among all the processes. Now, you might want to argue that isn't that what we're doing here? And to a certain extent, the answer is yes. But what's driving the multiplexing here? Right, but in particular, what about the processes? In other words, what's causing the context switch? Exactly. It's the I/O behavior, the non-compute behavior of the individual process. If you have a process that is heavily compute-bound, it is going to pig up the CPU. And that is going to ruin the illusion of one process, one CPU, for other processes that are lower down, in particular the interactive ones, because they're never going to get in the CPU because we have this hog in the front. Right? So while we're doing multiplexing here, we are not doing multiplexing, or another way to think about it is, we are not doing a very good job of presenting this virtual CPU abstraction. So what we need to do is we need to have a better scheduler that provides with a more realistic representation of this one process, one CPU. And how can we do that? Again, the problem here is things like this, hogs, what are technically known as hogs. How do we deal with that? Excellent. Okay. Priority, no. It's complicated. We have a more direct answer, which is essentially to chop up the big processes into smaller pieces. Okay? That's the essence of round-robin scheduling. See, I don't like the name because the name concentrates, it does in fact concentrate on, oops, I'm sorry, we're out of time.